To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does. Especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
This is your tech news briefing for Thursday, August 27th. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. As it turns out, putting thousands of kids back on college campuses created just the right environment for new outbreaks of the coronavirus. Now, campus administrators are caught between a rock and a hard place, between sharing important health data with students and violating their privacy. Our reporter David Uberti will break down what's going on after these headlines. Earlier this year, Apple released a beta version of its new operating system. iOS 14 contains new privacy features that make it harder for companies to track users from app to app. Yesterday, Facebook said the changes would cripple its audience network business. That's the part of Facebook that helps it serve targeted ads to Facebook users when they're using outside apps. Our reporter Jeff Horwitz says this is just the latest clash between the two tech giants.
It fundamentally stems from very different business models. Facebook sells ads and, they collect as much data as possible and from as many sources as possible. Apple, historically at least, sells devices. That's kind of a, more focused on the immediate user, obviously. And those different interests and different business models kind of conflict, in which Facebook generally wants the free flow of data. And Apple is, I think, known for being fairly stingy on that front, which, many of its users will tell you is exactly what they want based on privacy concerns.
A cyber attack brought New Zealand's stock market to a standstill yesterday for the second time in 2 days. The exchange says it was brought down both times by what's called a distributed denial of service attack. DDoS attacks flood networks with so much information that their websites and systems crash. The exchange also said that the attack was carried out from overseas, but didn't provide any evidence of that claim. And tens of thousands of students across the U.S. are getting ready for a hybrid remote and in-person school year without the computers they need for remote classes. We're seeing a shortage, and our Yoram Choi says there are a few reasons behind that.
There have been some supply chain disruptions that have caused some manufacturers to be behind schedule in meeting their orders. A second factor for why there is a laptop shortage is there's been a huge demand for these devices as a result of the pandemic forcing a lot of parents and students to start thinking of moving their education online, as well as parents deciding that, they need devices to work remotely at home. The third major reason is that there has been in recent weeks a move by the Department of Commerce, especially in the month of July, to sanction 11 Chinese companies for alleged human rights abuses. And one of those Chinese companies was a major laptop supplier for the company Lenovo, who is responsible for fulfilling the educational orders of many school districts seeking laptops and tablets.
And Yoram says school districts are making tough calls on how to ensure students have access to education with or without laptops.
One school district that I talked to, the Houston Independent School District, a spokesman for that district basically told me students who don't have either internet access or a device to work on in time for the start of the school year will have to, according to the state of Texas, attend the so-called learning centers, which are based in schools. So even while most students will be at home, because the decision was made to have them study remotely, at least for the first few weeks of the fall semester, these students will have to potentially risk getting infected with the coronavirus by attending these learning centers.
We've got more on what's already shaping up to be a hectic school year. After the break, how colleges are managing outbreaks among students and the data privacy concerns that come with them. That's next.
I may never have met you. We don't go way back. Maybe we wouldn't even be friends if we did. But when you wear a mask, you have my respect. Because your mask doesn't protect you. It protects me. I wear my mask to protect you. Mask up, America.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
many college students have returned to campus for an unusual fall semester. As some public health officials warned, bringing people together has resulted in new outbreaks of the coronavirus. Some universities are now reporting case numbers in the hundreds. Now, colleges are finding themselves in the tricky position of sharing important health information without violating students' privacy. And not everyone is taking the same approach. Our reporter David Uberti has been looking into this, and he joins us now to explain. Hey, Dave. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Amanda.
So how have universities been working to monitor cases so far?
So as universities across the country have tried to bring students back in a variety of capacities, a number of them have ramped up testing in many ways, either upon entry to campus or periodically at student health services. In some cases, they've rolled out apps on mobile phones to track when students are exposed to other students who might have tested positive. In other cases, they're requiring students to actually register their symptoms before they travel onto campus. So the upshot of all of this is universities are taking in an immense amount of data about students' health they've never taken in before. And the question is how they share that data with the public. We have these, you know, confined communities across the country where they're trying to bring in students for educational purposes. And no one really knows how it's going to work.
Right. So when there are outbreaks or other health information that's important to share, what are some of the ways we've seen them do that?
It's totally a patchwork. You have some universities who are reporting the number of case counts and positive test results daily. Some are doing so weekly. Some are not doing so at all. On the other end of the spectrum, you have some universities who are reporting the number of beds that are filled up in their quarantine or infirmary areas. So it's really, really a case-by-case basis in each university. And what you have is a really unequal set of data across the country, which makes it more and more difficult to compare how different reopening plans are working at a place, say, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, compared to Notre Dame, compared to the University of Arizona.
So why is there such a wide range of responses? What is it about this issue that makes it so challenging for schools to communicate the data?
In a word, it's privacy, broadly speaking. Universities have some obligation to report imminent threats to safety under federal law, but they're also wading into privacy debates to an extent they maybe haven't before. Obviously, they have to comply with HIPAA, which is the main federal privacy law regarding medical patient information. But in this case, they're also dealing with a law called the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which is typically a law that deals with student records. But in this case, universities are also interpreting it to include COVID case counts. So I spoke to a bunch of lawyers last week, and they essentially said that this law, FERPA, basically provides a lot of room for interpretation for how schools can go about this. And the end result is that we have a lot of these varying interpretations from individual universities. You know, it's a really gray area in terms of privacy law, and it's just hard for outside observers to really analyze.
And you mentioned the privacy concerns. What's the specific risk with this sort of patchwork response?
I mean, if you look at FERPA, it basically governs information that's personally identifiable. So the question that universities have to grapple with is, to what extent is the information they're releasing identifiable? So if they're releasing information about case counts, is that in some ways identifiable for a particular group? If they're identifying a cluster of cases on campus, if they're identifying the number of cases within that cluster or the specific address where that cluster is that in some ways identifiable? And that's really an open question depending on your interpretation of the law. Now, you have some administrators and some public health experts that are basically saying, hey, look, universities are using this law for PR purposes. They're taking a very conservative approach to FERPA, and they're releasing less of this data because they want to confine the amount of information that's available publicly.
Dave, obviously, all this has a really big impact on the students. How have they been responding to all this confusion? What have they told you?
I mean, in many cases, particularly in states like North Carolina, take UNC Chapel Hill, take NC State, they've been really vocal in how they're pushing back against the administration. They want more data in almost every case. I spoke to 5 students over the last week at both UNC and NC State. And, you know, they were very critical of the ways in which their university administration had shared data. But on a more personal level, I mean, it's a tough time to be a student. I mean, you're coming back to class. You're either in a small dormitory with 1 or 2 roommates. Maybe you're starting your senior year at college, and you really don't know you know, whether you should be worried about going outside to hang out with friends. You don't know whether it's safe for you to go to a restaurant locally. And they're really just sort of playing a guessing game on a day-by-day basis in terms of whether this is a really serious problem on their particular campus. And I spoke to some students at UNC, which, you know, shuttered much of its underclass housing on campus. And some students there were worried as well about whether it was safe for them to travel back home, just given the extent of the outbreak there. So in addition to all of these legal questions and all these public health concerns and whether universities really can be the laboratories where we test how reopening does or doesn't work, you have thousands and thousands of thousands of kids at the center of all of this who are really living through an uncertain situation.
And zooming out here, this balance that universities are trying to find, is this a totally new challenge for them, or is the pandemic just shedding new light on a kind of a broader issue?
You know, I spoke to one public health professor at a university last week who said essentially that this isn't a new transparency concern for universities, but it's essentially bringing universities' existing transparency concerns out into the public eye to a much greater extent. In the past, universities have used laws like FERPA to not release records related to sexual assault or other misconduct records. In this case, you've had sort of an explosion in the amount of data that universities say are covered by this law. So it really, really brings those questions to the fore of how much data universities are legally obligated to release and how much data they should be releasing for broader public health concerns.
Our reporter, David Uberti, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And that was your tech news briefing. We've got lots more tech stories on our website, WSJ.com. And if you like our show, please do rate and review us. It really does help. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.